It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 85, for Friday, the 20th of July, 2012. On the show this week, the Collins Dictionary crowdsources new words for its future dictionaries, including amazeballs and omnishambles. We'll find out why. Also, Apple is told that not only was Samsung not copying its iPad design, but it must advertise that same fact on its own website and in British newspapers. And we keep you abreast of the latest medieval news as a bra from the 1400s is discovered, shedding light on the history of the lady garment. All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, Nate Langston here, not very well. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk still though, and joining me, associate editor Olivia _ Solon.
Hello.
And of course, our editorial assistant, Ian Steadman.
Hello.
Or Instead, as I think your nickname should be.
Oh, finally, yes.
See what I did there?
We've been trying to come up with a nickname for a while now.
We have. We are sans donuts this week. Duncan is in the Faroe Islands. I think he's at a festival.
Yeah, he's at a music festival in the Faroes.
These are the things that we do for work.
Yeah.
You know, we go to festivals and write about the people behind them and stuff.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, I'm still dying, so I apologise for my voice. I've been very ill. Haven't I?
You have. You've been snotting all over the shop.
I have.
Well, you haven't been in work most of the week.
No, I've been working at home to protect you guys. Because we don't take sick days, we just stay at home and work. Yeah. That's how we rock in the Wired ship. A judge has ruled that Apple must post a notice on its UK homepage to say that Samsung did not copy the design of the iPad with its Galaxy Tab tablet computer. And it must also take out advertisements in several newspapers and magazines to the same effect. This actually follows a ruling on the 9th of July, where High Court Judge Colin Burse said that Samsung's tablet does not infringe Apple's design because the Android-powered Galaxy Tab is, quote, not as cool as the iPad. I think we may have talked about that in a past show.
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is payback for having the cooler tablet, presumably.
A little bit, yeah. So Apple's got to post this notice on its homepage for 6 months that Samsung didn't copy the iPad with its Galaxy Tab. And also, according to a draft copy of the order provided by Samsung's lawyers, Apple's also got to take out adverts in the Financial Times, the Daily Mail, Guardian Mobile Magazine, and the Gadget Mag T3 to the same effect. Now, this is got to be the most annoyed Tim Cook has ever been to hear this news. Like, I mean, this is like really rubbing the salt in the wound, because this is the kind of thing that you have to do if you lose a libel lawsuit. Like, if a newspaper libels somebody, you know, quite often one of the things they have to do to make up for that, aside from a fine, is to print an apology on its front page and have it on a website. That is kind of what this sounds like to me. It's almost like it's the same. It's the punishment.
It's all, because I've never actually seen anything like this happen before. I imagine they'll stash it away in some kind of corner of the website. But have you ever seen a site where it says, oh, by the way, here's our mobile phone and we did not copy whoever, Motorola or...
No, I mean, we've seen cases where, they've issued things like a press release or a statement, or it's cropped up in like investor calls and things like that. Yeah. But never... I've seen to be posted on a homepage for 6 months. Mm. I mean, Apple's homepage is quite a weird sort of design in a way, because it's just basically one giant image when you arrive at it, and then a few sort of little things below that. So it's going to be very interesting to see where it gets away with posting this, because obviously they're going to want to sort of write it in the same color text as the background at the bottom of the page.
It's there.
You know, it's there technically. You know, Google can see it, but no one else can. So be very interesting to see what happens there. No doubt Apple will want to appeal this decision, and we shall find out what happens. In the meantime, though, Liv... things that aren't quite so amazeballs, or are.
Well, I think this is more amazeballs, to be honest.
It's because my brain's full of, you know...
snot.
Yeah.
Well, Collins Dictionaries launched an initiative to find new word submissions from members of the public. Currently, the only way that it gets new words into its dictionary is by having the editors track a database that they have that looks at all these different media sources. But now they've opened up their kind of closed submissions process to let you or I add new words.
And a few words have already been suggested, including amazeballs.
Well, I want to know if you've heard of any of these, all to right, be honest. Ream.
No. Well, I've heard it's in a ream of paper.
Yes. What is it?
I could not define it for you.
This is R-E-E-M.
R-E-E-M. It's a compliment, and it's used by the cast of The Only Way is Essex, yes. a.k.a. Towie.
Well, me and Ian would never know that.
Omni Shambles was initially coined in the thick of it, but has more recently been used by Ed Miliband. Mantyhose?
No,
but I can at least guess what they are.
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
jeggings, but thinner?
No, tights for men.
Okay.
I didn't know men wear tights.
No, they're a new thing. It's a new phenomenon. Check it out.
Mantyhose. Should they be called mites? That'd be better.
Well,
we don't
it's
call
the
them
US. They call them pantyhose.
But we call them tights and mites.
But I think
a bit more manly.
It's probably a US Americanism. And the final one, tash on.
Tash on?
Yeah.
Is that
this is one that's very close to my heart.
To wear a moustache?
No, it's to make out. It's from Geordie Shore, which is my hideous little secret.
Can I just be a real snob here and say I don't think that, you know, reality TV morons are the people who should be coining new terms.
I want to add this. They're not coining the terms. These are terms that they use. They are then being showcased in front of the world in these TV programs.
They're being popularized. They're becoming mainstream through this.
And as a result, they're being used and written up about and put into the other places in the media. And that is how words are born.
You know,
exactly.
Amazeballs.
Back in the day, it was Shakespeare inventing thousands of words for plays. And now it's Towie.
But you wrote an interesting article last year, I think, about the Oxford English Dictionary running in this sort of competition when it started.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of liken how the OED started to Wikipedia, which is that when the OED started, it was essentially a crowdsourced movement. And basically, the guy who was spearheading the whole thing would send out books to anyone who agreed to go through books and log basically metadata against each word, like where its first appearance was, what the context was, what its derived meaning is from that context, things like that, and then send these slips of paper back in to the dictionary editors, and they would then cross-reference and compile them and create a definition that was formalized. And they did this over decades. It took so long, but it was effectively just crowdsourced.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what this is, in a sense.
And I think it's hard for the editors to keep up with how the pace of change of the language. So, but if you've got a word that you want to add, I don't know what your favourite.
Well, I used the word snooze earlier to sneeze.
Yeah.
I snooze so hard I almost dropped my tissue was the context. I used that on Twitter. And I also like the word squoze, you know, as in, you know, I squeezed an orange, I squoze that orange.
See, I don't think that's a different enough
that's
word.
That's not coining a new word, is it? That's just...
kind of coining a new tense.
Yeah, that's...
sort of. Yeah, I suppose.
What about you, Ian? Have you got any words that you don't feel are in the dictionary that you need to add? Bum weasel.
No, off the top of my head. No.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
what words would you add to the dictionary? podcast@wideuk.uk. Or actually, better still, leave them on our Facebook wall, facebook.com/wideuk. And we all, I don't know, maybe we can start using some in stories. Because that's how words were sort of, that's how they would, they had to appear in like print a certain number of times to basically qualify for dictionary inclusion.
And that's the same here. That's what all the editors will do, is they will check to see if your word is being used enough everywhere else, or it's just you saying it over and over again on your Twitter feed.
Yeah, we'll see. Let's move on to some 3D printed... Well, Ian, let's move on to Ian and you can explain the story.
Yes, this is great news for criminals and other ne'er-do-wells.
Excellent.
it is a German hacker. He calls himself Ray. That's
good name.
The way we know him as. Distinctive. He was at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in New York on the 13th, 15th of July. And he presented something that was quite interesting. He managed to 3D print on his computer keys to some high-security handcuffs. These aren't the handcuffs you can go down and buy in a joke store or an army store or whatever. Anything like that. These are the kind of ones that people who really need to keep people with their eyes, their hands tied together.
It's criminals, not romantic partners.
Yeah. Exactly. But what Ray had done, which is quite simple, he'd taken these two brands, Chubb and Bonovi, who I think are German, or Bonovi, perhaps, and he'd basically just bought some spare keys on eBay, taken them home, measured them with some calipers, drawn up some computer models, and then printed them out in plexiglass. And then he'd managed to open these handcuffs quite easily just by using the plexiglass keys.
It's another interesting application for sort of 3D scanning, but it raises a lot of very interesting questions, because we saw this happen with Lego pieces. There was a Kickstarter project a few months ago, I think, where they had come up with these, like, they were Kinex pieces that you could meet, that meant you could attach Kinex to Lego. Yeah. It was like half Kinex, half Lego. And it sort of raised a whole lot of questions about things like, you know, intellectual property and stuff like that. And now this, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because plastic keys presumably are much easier to get through security and to perhaps...
Oh, they are. And the problem is, these are the exact kind of handcuffs you'd use, say, on a plane to transport a prisoner. So you really don't want anyone to be able to sneak them through.
I guess the only challenge would be that you... If the prisoner didn't already have an extra pair of keys, they were unlikely to have contact with the CAD modelling files and the 3D printers that would need to create new key.
But could you imagine this? Could you imagine a case where a padlock or key company kept a digital database of all of its keys, you know, under sort of high encryption and whatever, you know, in case a key was lost and they had to print a new one on demand? Yeah. Now imagine if that database was hacked.
In the wrong hands.
I mean, I'm just...
You'd have to spend millions, billions replacing the handcuffs of every police force around the world.
I find it fascinating. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, I don't know what's going to come out of this.
Don't they now use those kind of plastic...
Yeah, but they've still... Oh, what, the cable ties?
Yeah.
I guess that's a low-grade, low-tech solution.
Well, exactly.
Personally, I prefer my handcuffs to be fluffy.
Good.
Wait, let's chop that out of the show.
let's not.
Okay. Actually, let's move on to medieval lingerie, Liv, because a team of Austrian archaeologists have discovered four linen bras from the 1400s. And this reveals that women wore this popular garment about 500 years before fashion historians thought that they were invented.
Yeah.
This is a pretty amazing discovery. I think.
This is bra-mazing.
There's one for Collins.
No, that's terrible. Sorry, Collins dictionary.
But they resemble modern bras because they have like distinctly cut cups. They were found amongst like 2,700 textile fragments in Kassel Lengberg in Austria by researchers from the University of Innsbruck, stuffed inside a vault in the building.
I mean, as a woman, I just find it hard to believe that people thought that bras were invented so late. I mean, it's just, they're just incredibly practical things, and I imagine as soon as you got any kind of sense of learning how to sew, it'd be the first thing you'd create.
You'd have thought so. I mean, I think historians put the invention with a French corset maker in the 1700s, and someone got a patent for it in 1914.
Yeah, but what do they think women did before that? Just,
well, you know, toast was patented. Someone patented a method of something like refreshing bread with heat, and they got granted a patent on that. That still stands today.
Ridiculous.
So it was sort of a first bit of patent trolling, but quite interesting. But it does mean that medieval texts, and there were quite a few of these that describe like bra-like garments, sometimes mentioning pockets for the breasts or shirts with bags.
I love that. I love the shirts with bags.
Shirts with bags were, in fact, in these texts describing what we do know as a bra today. But until now, there wasn't any physical proof that was the case. So, I mean, there's lots of puns and jokes I could make, but I feel that it would be childish and cheapening this discovery, Liv.
Oh, no, oh, go on.
Don't let us stand in the way of cheapening this discovery.
Well, I did say we're getting abreast of the news.
You did.
In the intro.
Tick.
That was good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But let's move on. We're going to talk about nanobots, aren't we, Ian?
We are indeed.
They don't need any bras.
Yes, they don't need bras. Well, you could create a nanobot that could make a bra.
That's true.
Yeah. These nanobots, though, are designed to deal with plastic in the ocean, which is a massive problem. Just to outline it, there is this thing, the Great Pacific Plastic Patch, which, if you haven't heard of it, I'll just explain what it is. It's there's the North Pacific Gyre in the North Pacific. It's a series of currents that go in a circle. Stuff that goes into the middle of there gets trapped. It can't come out again. And we humans have been dumping plastic in the oceans for decades, and now there is a lot of plastic in there. No one knows exactly how much because it is so big. But some people estimate between 40 to 100 million tons of plastic across about an 8 million square kilometer area.
Wow. It's all in one giant clump, isn't it?
Well, it's not really. This is the problem. It's kind of because the plastic floats on the surface, it gets broken down under the sun and turns into very small polymers, which are often microscopic in size, and they hover underneath the surface for, you know, up to 30-40 meters. And the ocean around there is less of an ocean and more kind of like a plastic soup. And that means that cleaning up is really difficult, but you need to clean it up because it gets into the food stream through fish and turtles and other things, and eventually to us, which is quite unpleasant. But the problem is there's so much plastic, of course, you can't actually physically go around with a bucket picking it up and taking it out of the ocean.
So what, these nanobots are going to go in there and turn it into
an island? Yeah, this is the proposal by a bunch of students at UCL. They think that what they're going to do is create some nanobots that will stick the plastic together again. Once it gets to a big enough size, you can start clumping the big clumps together and make Plastic Island, which is what they call it. And the idea is that you'd make an island that was eventually big enough, people would want to live on it or holiday on it.
It's an incredibly brilliant use for upcycling.
Yes.
Another term that should be in Collins Dictionary.
Yes, it should be.
Because we use it all the time.
Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, it's kind of, that's how moons were created.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Bits of dirt coalesced to form planets and rocks.
Yeah, and it just comes from looking at it basically as a resource instead of a problem that needs to be removed. It's still not going to be amazing. I mean, I don't know about you. I wouldn't want to live on just a lump of plastic on the ocean. There'd have to be, you know, soil on it or something like that. So it requires some work.
Well, lots of people sit in boats, don't they? They're kind of big lumps of carbon fiber.
Yeah,
but they move around. This one would be in one place, I guess.
They do.
So I mean, how would, do they propose that this could work? I mean, who's going to pay for this?
Well, they don't know yet because it's still quite theoretical, but they are looking for a little bit of funding on the crowdfunding site SponsorMe, which is,
I see what they did there.
Yes. SponsorMe. They're looking for about £1,500 just to sort of look into this a bit further. So,
well, if you've got £1,500 and want to sponsor the creation of a plastic island that effectively upcycles dirt into something you could own and live on, go to SponsorMe, I guess, and get pledging with your wedge of cash. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to blow my nose incredibly hard. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the rights group that's been fined for not paying artist royalties on anti-piracy ads.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back. Had a good sneeze. Thanks. Liv, you wrote a story this week about a rights group potentially, not two-faced? Is that the word?
Yeah, a bit hypocritical, perhaps.
All right.
So what happened was, it's a fairly complicated story, but there was a musician called Melchior Rietveld. I'm not entirely sure if that's how you pronounce it, but he's a Dutch musician. And he was asked back in 2006 by an anti-piracy association called Brein, B-R-E-I-N, to compose a tune that they wanted to use for an anti-piracy ad that they were going to show at a local film festival, which they did. And he, you know, that was fine. But a year later, Rietveld bought a DVD of Harry Potter and found that the ad was actually being distributed on this DVD and actually globally and very widely without having his permission and without him having collected any royalties for it. So he goes to his royalty collection agency, which is called Boomer Stemra, and said, hey, I'm owed loads of money. You've got to give me this money that I'm owed. And they said, okay, we'll give you 15,000 euros now, but and then we'll try and work out on how many CDs, DVDs this music's been used. But there was lots of back and forth, and they didn't seem to come back to him with this extensive list. So he took them to court. And I guess what's important to point out is actually Brein is an organisation of lots of different rights groups, one of which is, in fact, his royalties agency's Boomer Stemra. So they're kind of one and the same thing. So he's battled with this agency to get the royalties for this music that was used in an anti-piracy ad. And he's just won. He's just been awarded 20,000 euros. Boomer Stemra has been ordered to pay him up to 160 euro.
160,000 euros.
Sorry, 160,000 euros, yes.
Yeah. 20,000 euros, that's not very much money. If he was given 15,000 in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was put on Harry Potter DVDs. Now, I've heard they sell quite well.
Yes, well, that's where the 160,000 euro comes in. But the 20,000 was more of a penalty, kind of a fine that they got made to pay. And they had to cover all his legal costs. But this was the additional, the kind of royalties was the 160,000 euro.
It strikes me this would be one of those cases that sort of, you know, it's kind of, a little bit fun for us to sort of point and say, haha, double standards, whatever. But it's probably just something incredibly silly, like a, you know, a badly written clause in a contract where one company thought they had the rights to do something and the other guy didn't. And it's just some really bad legalese that wasn't translated.
And that is entirely possible. I guess the problem here was it took a very long time to get this sorted, to the point where he had to go to a court. And it probably could have been sorted much, much more easily. I think that's the reason why we've kind of flagged it up as being moderately amusing, is that it was the music for use in a piracy ad. But yes, it's just a kind of interesting story.
It is. And thank you for sharing it with us, Lily.
That's all right. No problem. Anytime.
Of all days. Other, you know, things in the news that I thought were quite big is that Yahoo has got a new CEO, and this is none other than Marissa Mayer, the 37-year-old Google executive and employee number 20 at Google, who announced the move on Monday, and her first day was no sooner than the very next day. That's this week, at least when we're recording. She started on the Tuesday.
And what number is this in CEOs at Yahoo in the last 12 months? Well, 5 or 6?
Yeah, I suppose we should recap. I mean, Yahoo has it's not had the greatest track record over the last few years in terms of business moves and in terms of CEO retention, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So Mayer's joining comes after... Well, let's start with Jerry Yang, actually. So Jerry Yang, who was one of the co-founders of Yahoo, stepped down from the CEO post in 2009, but not before turning down a $44 billion offer for acquisition from Microsoft. Today, Yahoo's market cap is just under $20 billion, you know, which is less than half what Microsoft was offering. So it was seen as being, not a great move. So he stepped down, and after that, Carol Bartz took over, and Bartz is a very, very experienced businesswoman, had spent many, many years at Autodesk, which makes some incredibly popular sort of CAD design software and things like that. And she closed down a lot of Yahoo properties. She really wanted to sort of streamline the business. She thought that Yahoo had too many fingers in too many pies. Mm. She closed down some really popular stuff, including GeoCities, in order to turn the company around. Problem is, it didn't work, and Bartz was fired from Yahoo late last year. So this brings us up to about the beginning of 2012. Scott Thompson left the role of PayPal president and took over as CEO in early 2012 and announced a whole bunch of plans again to sort of refine the company, cut quite a lot of staff, I think about 10 or 12, maybe even slightly more percent of its workforce, in order to refine what Yahoo was as a company. And then he was let go not long after some controversy over his reported qualifications. I'm not going to go into those in too much detail because it's not massively clear, but there were some questions whether he had a particular degree, and it was very, very messy. So he was let go. And now Marissa Mayer stepped in, and it feels a bit like a cursed role. You know, Yahoo's value has been going down.
Yeah.
It's not been seen as an innovator. People aren't really sure. Is it a tech company? Is it a media company? What is Yahoo? What's it stand for? You know, it's sort of... It sold out its search business to Microsoft with Bing. I think Yahoo provides a lot of advertising solutions, if you like, I think, for Microsoft. I think that's how they did it. But no one's really sure what Yahoo is. It still has an insanely high number of users and produces, you know, a huge amount of original content for things like news and stuff like that.
It's still the fourth most visited site in the world.
Yeah, it's absolutely massive. It's kind of this giant that's just sort of standing still, looking around at all the little people at its feet.
And every time we've seen a new CEO, we've expected something kind of exciting to happen. But in terms of product development or innovation, there hasn't been anything, has there?
There hasn't, but that's what's so exciting about Marissa Mayer taking over. She is something of a Google veteran. You know, she's been there since the beginning. She was there until literally this week. She's seen the company go from being a tiny little startup in a garage to being, you know, the multi-billion dollar search giant that overhauls everything that it is today and everything in between. So it really also cements the fact, I think, that Yahoo wants to be seen as a technology company. I think that's one of the first things you can draw from this, because to get someone like Marissa Mayer in with the experience she has with Google means they want to focus on her skills and how they can be applied to Yahoo, which suggests they want to be more tech than media. I think that's interesting thing one.
Well, surely tech underpins media now so much. They're so inextricably linked these days.
It does, but then you look at Yahoo and you still can't quite work out which one it is, whether it is trying to be one or the other.
Yeah,
and
I guess media advertising technology perhaps, rather than creating content, so to speak.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see what she does there, but I mean, the one thing that's interesting is that Google doesn't produce any original content.
No.
You know, recently it started producing things like, you know, Android and social networks, but that's still very much kind of other developers writing apps,
yeah,
or it's user-generated content. Google isn't in the business of creating stuff. It's in the business of collating and organizing what other people create. So bringing that experience to Yahoo could be very, very interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is that this is the first time in many years that I've genuinely seen people excited about Yahoo again.
Yeah.
The buzz all over the web and over social networks over the last few days has been, this is a great move.
She's, you know, really well respected.
She's extremely well respected, knowledgeable. She was in charge of Google's search business for a long time. She's in charge of their user interface experience, so things like the number of words that appear on the Google homepage, all that clean layout, stuff like that, you know, that is, you know, vastly attributed to her input and decision making. So I think it's really good, and she's young as well, you know. It's a really exciting move, and I think this, I don't know, I've never wanted to see Yahoo fail. I don't think anyone really wants to see Yahoo fail. It's kind of this weird struggling giant in some markets, and I think this could be, if nothing else, some extremely good PR for once, and hopefully.
Yeah, and I think it's always good for Google to have some serious competition. I don't know how serious it is at the moment, but I think it's a worrying world in which there isn't any viable competition for a company as large as Google.
Mm. Yeah, I think, well, Yahoo and Bing, at least in the US, make up the second largest search, but it's second largest to a very, you know, massive number. And I think in Europe, Google has like 85 or 90% of the search market. So even being number two to that means you have at most about 10-12%. I'm not sure the exact current figures, but it's quite small. So exciting stuff for Yahoo. It'll be a very interesting few months to see what changes she starts to make. I say bring GeoCities back, but that's just my opinion. That's the show.
That is.
Ian, we've done another show with you.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Liv's going to tell everyone how they can get in touch.
I am. There's so many ways. The first way that I would suggest getting in touch is by emailing us, podcast@wired.co.uk. If you've got any ideas for the words that you might want to invent and pop into the Collins Dictionary, send them over. You can also catch us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. And we have a fantastic Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And if you want to give us a call, you can call us from a landline or a mobile on 0208 123 0468. Leave us a message.
We had some more heavy breathing on that account this week. I think a lot of people sort of call up not really knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
And then sort of leave no message.
I haven't called it up. Do we have a friendly message saying leave a message? Yeah. Or is it just
picking
it up?
It's me. You get to hear me. It says, hi, leave us a message, sounding healthier than I do right now.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm going to give it a call and heavy breathe down the phone.
Leave us a message. We're actually going to start, we're going to have some things to give away every week for people who write in with the best feedback. We shan't give too much away, but let's say you can wear them and they may or may not feature the faces of your favourite hosts. Let's just leave it at that, shall we? That's coming soon. Until next week, though, ta-ra.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Today in sneezing.